Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today we have a very special show for you. We'll be joined for the full hour by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! To be talking about media, politics, and war and peace. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
With the passage of the Local Community Radio Act late last year, potentially thousands of new low-power FM or LPFM radio stations could be built in cities and towns across the country. Earlier this month, the Federal Communications Commission released a proposal that starts the process of determining exactly how to enact the legislation. But the FCC has some unfinished business to attend to first, namely the thousands of translator applications that have been pending at the commission for the last 6 years.
Translators are repeater stations. They're small FM radio stations that repeat the signals of other stations. And traditionally, they're used to extend the signal of a station to reach a little bit further. For example, a station in the city that might want to reach out to the suburbs can use a translator to do so. What's happened today is that a number of large translator networks are using translators in a different way. They're using translators to blanket the entire country with the same programming, in some cases, rather than extending the signal of a particular station in a particular area.
That's Brandy Doyle, policy director of the Prometheus Radio Project, a group that helps organizations build and run community radio stations, as well as advocates for their interests in Washington. The FCC put a freeze on translator applications in 2005 when it realized that if all these applications were granted, there would no longer be any space for new community stations to go on the air, the kind that would produce local original programming. The agency's job now is to balance the existing translator applications with the thousands of potential locations for new radio stations.
To ensure that there are channels for community radio around the country, the FCC has to figure out how to divide up the open frequencies that are still remaining in cities and towns between low-power FM stations for community radio and translator stations. There are over 6,500 pending applications for translators at the FCC, and the new rules would propose a way to allow some of the open frequencies to go to translators and some to go to community radio stations. The FCC is proposing to ensure that a minimum number of channels in the nation's largest cities are available for low-power FM.
Doyle encourages people who want real local radio in their communities to contact the FCC and tell them how important it is to ensure that the agency's rules create plenty of space for new stations to go on the air. You can send a message to the FCC by going to the Prometheus Radio Project's website at prometheusradio.org.
A new public media project is trying to prove the premise that everyone's got a story to share. The project is called My Life is True, and for 2 short minutes, people share a snippet of their life, like this one.
I took the bus to drop the kids off at school. I came back 2 hours later. My place was broken into. My groceries, my laptop, the kids' savings money, gone. I called everybody that wasn't scared to help me move. I loaded up their cars and moved back to my mom's house. My kids started crying. I was heartbroken.
The project was created by 2 fellows at the New America Foundation, Ann Stoldreyer and Doug McRae. The stories were produced by KQED's Perspectives and aired in Northern California during NPR's Morning Edition. McGray said he was drawn to the project because he respects the power of storytelling.
I'm a huge fan of public radio and of storytelling. It's the way we learn, really. It helps put things in context. It helps give the world some order and help us understand complicated ideas.
A longtime journalist and writer, McGray is used to interviewing subjects and filtering their stories for the audience. But with this project, people tell their own stories in their own voice with compelling results.
When you're driving around listening to the radio, you get used to a certain voice. I think it's really valuable to hear different voices, to hear people who've maybe had a different life experience. And you're not just hearing them quoted, you're actually hearing them talking directly to you.
Along with airing the stories on the radio, they're also displayed online alongside documentary-style illustrations by artist Wendy McNaughton.
When we were thinking about how we wanted these to live online, there was something really intimate and really personal about her work that we thought paired really nicely with it.
To listen to the first three stories of the project, visit mylifeistrue.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today, July 31st, 2011, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a recorded show for you, one that I taped with our guest about 2 weeks before going on air. Our guest is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, where she's the executive producer and co-anchor, also a newspaper columnist and author of numerous books, including most recently Breaking the Sound Barrier. Is that the last one, Amy?
That is.
Breaking the Sound Barrier. And she's also the author of Standing Up to the Madness, which she co-authored with David Goodman, Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back, and also The Exception to the Rulers, her first book. So she's a well-known author, journalist, reporter, and I think probably someone who I've given a much longer introduction than she needs for our listening audience. Amy, thanks so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule to join us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Bob.
Well, you know, I want to talk about some of the stories you've been covering on Democracy Now! And you've been writing about in your newspaper column. But one of the things I often get asked by our listeners or by my students or people I come in touch with who are very impressed with your program, Democracy Now!, is how it works. I mean, just maybe if you could just take a second, you know, what is a day in Democracy Now! Like? How do you get that show together? How do you pick the stories? How does that work?
Well, use the example of today. It's a brain trust of people who gather together, and as soon as the show ends, we just did an interview, for example. We played the whole hour with a young man, 24 years old, named David House, who was called before the grand jury looking into WikiLeaks. It's a secret grand jury that was impaneled in Alexandria, Virginia. And when I was in London, July 4th weekend, interviewing Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks editor-in-chief, I bumped into David. And he himself is an incredible figure because he was one of the few people who had visited Bradley Manning repeatedly at Quantico when he was held in solitary confinement and got word out about the conditions under which he was being held. Bradley Manning is the private, the soldier in Iraq who the U.S. government has accused of leaking documents to WikiLeaks. And so here was David House, bumped into him on the street in London, and he is part of a group of, he doesn't like really to be called hacker, activist, whatever you'd like, people who are deeply committed to independent information. And, you know, what's happening in this country around WikiLeaks is different than in other countries where you have the media in a very regular way talking about how the documents that have been released from the U.S. State Department through WikiLeaks have affected them and their headlines across the world. So this is a sort of spin-off from that because it's a young man who was working at MIT and the U.S. government has targeted him, though he ultimately has not at this point been imprisoned. So we ran the whole hour with him. Today, right after that is done, our colleagues, you know, we gather around and we talk about the stories of the day. President Obama has just held a news conference around the debt deal, and we throw around ideas. We talk about what, you know, this could be one day or any day, because certainly the issue of the deficit and where the deficit comes from is one we've been talking about a lot. And the media focuses on two areas. They focus on Social Security and they focus on Medicare. How much to cut? Not even so much do you cut, but how much to cut. What about war? You know, they're talking about trillions of dollars in deficit. Well, what does the war cost us? I mean, you have this new study out of Brown University and Boston University, Professor Lutz at Brown and Professor Crawford at Boston University. The costs of war are unimaginable. I mean, we can't actually quantify it because in addition to the real costs of, what was it, $2 billion dollars every week in dealing with the wars in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, you have the lives lost and you have the untold cost of all of these wounded warriors coming home, those who suffer PTSD, those who suffer physical problems, who must be taken care of all their lives. We can't even quantify how much this costs us. So if we're talking about dealing with a deficit, and these are the ideas we bounce around, you know, who is a good person to talk to on this? We start reaching out. Human Rights Watch has come out with recommendations to go after the Bush administration right on up to President Bush over the issue of torture. And so talking with Ken Roth, then he's the head of Human Rights Watch. But what about having a debate, for example, with John Yoo, one of the people that Human Rights Watch fingers as one of the people who should be investigated? It would be very interesting to have that discussion. So we're building this throughout the day, talking, calling people, researching, and, you know, by the night it might be totally blown out because another story happens that now we have to cancel all our guests for the next day. But it's a back and forth between a group of people who are deeply committed to getting independent news out.
Now, Amy Goodman, I have to ask you, now we're recording this a couple of weeks before going on air, so this story might be dated by then, but I'm just wondering how lengthy were your deliberations on how you were going to cover the Casey Anthony story?
Well, I mean, it is not, when a child dies, there's nothing humorous about it, but the nonstop cable coverage, when you think about the number of casualties in the world and in this country, the neglect through abuse and violence, this is a very serious issue, but because the media only focused in on this one issue, we thought they pretty much had it covered, and there was so much we had to deal with that imperils children and adults that we didn't spend our time talking about that.
Amy Goodman, you were just in London, and you did a public event with Julian Assange from WikiLeaks. And, you know, I was wondering, you know, what's your sense of how good a job have the American news media done in sort of fighting to battle government secrecy and to protect the rights of the Bradley Mannings and the WikiLeaks to sort of expose, actual record of what the government's doing?
What the media has missed in the WikiLeaks story are the actual documents, how serious they are, how revealing they are, and we're taking them very seriously one by one. I mean, Spain, the headlines across the country and El País and others was how the U.S. ambassador to Spain, a banker from Texas, appointed by Bush, Edward Aguirre, his intervention at every level of government and trying to prevent cases from moving forward around holding the Bush administration accountable. Not to mention one of their own reporters, Jose Coso, who is a young cameraman who worked for Telecinco, was killed April 8, 2003 at the Palestine Hotel when the U.S. military, this is the day before the fall of Baghdad, the U.S. military tank opens fire on this hotel of hundreds of unembedded journalists. They killed two. Reuters, Taras Pratsyuk was a Ukrainian cameraman working for Reuters, and Jose Coso was on his balcony filming. He was working for the Spanish network Telecinco, and they were both killed. So Jose's brother, Javier, and his mother have nonstop since his death in 2003 tried to hold the soldiers accountable, those who killed their loved one, and they've sued the U.S. government. They've sued the lower-level soldiers because they know their names and they know what they did. But they are trying to get information from the highest level of government. You know, how high did this command go to open fire on the Palestine Hotel? And now we see that the U.S. ambassador was intervening at every level to stop this, not to mention to stop the lawsuit moving forward that involved Bush administration officials around the issue of torture. So this is big headlines in Spain, and it's very concrete. In this country, I think people have very little idea. They just know, I mean, the only debate is who Julian Assange is. But whether Assange is, but who Assange is would be relevant if he wrote the documents. Then it really matters. Issues of integrity, can you trust him? Because, you know, can you trust the documents? The fact of the matter is, you know, the documents that have been released by WikiLeaks, the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs, these are written by low-level soldiers right up the chain of command, the daily logs of what happens in war. They're not written by Julian Assange or WikiLeaks. And then you have the latest trove of documents released of U.S. State Department cables, which are about 250,000 of them. They're being released over time. They're the largest trove of State Department documents ever released in history. And they're written by State Department employees. They're written by diplomats. They're written by people high up and lower down, but they're not written by Assange. And so the issue isn't who Assange is. The issue is what these documents say about how we conduct foreign policy in the world, or how the U.S. does. And they're extremely revealing, very important, and they must be taken seriously. And networks in this country, particularly TV networks, have done a disservice to the American people for not delving into them and giving them the weight that they deserve, because they are telling us about what is being done in our name. And I want to just give one example, if
Please
we have
do.
A moment. I want to go to what was released in the Iraq War documents. Just one story, for example. It was February 2007, and an Apache helicopter, U.S. Apache helicopter, was overhead in Baghdad. And the soldiers in the Apache helicopter, this is one of the reports from the Iraq War logs, see below them two men with their hands up, two Iraqis. And they call back to base, and they say, what should we do? They seem to want to surrender. And a lawyer at the base said, you can't surrender to a helicopter, so they blew these guys away. That was February 2007. We didn't know about this until the WikiLeaks documents were released in 2010, 3 years later. Why does this matter? I think Americans are a compassionate people. And if they heard about these soldiers blowing away two men trying to surrender below, there would have been an investigation. They would have said, why? It was apparent to the soldiers that they were trying to surrender, so much so that they weren't rogue. They didn't do things on their own. They called back to base and said, what should we do? Now we'll jump forward 5 months from February 2007 to July 2007, July 12, 2007 to be exact. It was when the same Apache helicopter unit is flying over an area of Baghdad called New Baghdad. They see a group of men below. It turns out that among those men are journalists. There's Namir Nur Eladin, who is a young Iraqi videographer for Reuters, and his driver, Saeed Shema, 40 years old, father of four. And the men in the neighborhood are taking them around. Well, this Apache unit sees them below. Again, they're not rogue. These soldiers call back to base. They want permission to open fire. They get it, and they do. And because this is video that I'm talking about now from July 12, 2007, that was released by WikiLeaks, video taken by the Apache helicopter. I mean, it is just chilling. You see them blow away these men below, and then Saeed Shema is trying to crawl away, and they're asking for permission to open fire again. They get it, and they blow him away as a van pulls up to try to help him, and they blow up the van, and there are two children who are critically injured in the van. I think if we knew what had happened in February of 2007 at the time, if there was an investigation done, that Apache unit 5 months later would not have blown up Namir, Saeed, and the other men who were there, because their tactics would have been questioned by the American people. That's why truth matters. You know, when you expose the lies, the cover-ups, it saves lives.
Our guest, Amy Goodman, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILLAM 580, coming to you this Sunday. We recorded the program a couple of weeks before going on air, so please don't try to call in and Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the late summer broadcast. Amy Goodwin, while you were in England, I suspect you overlapped the burgeoning scandal with Rupert Murdoch's and his empire in England. And I was just wondering what your take is on this scandal and this crisis.
Oh, well, I mean, it's truly astounding. As we were flying out of London after interviewing Julian Assange and David House, who established the Bradley Manning Support Network, we're watching on TV at Heathrow this scandal unfolding. It is enormous because Rupert Murdoch owns, what, a third of the media in Britain, the oldest newspaper, News of the World, he had to shut down over the phone hacking scandal. Really significant what this is all about. I mean, you have this media mogul who's trying to buy BSkyB, the TV satellite network, who now has had to close down Britain's biggest selling Sunday newspaper, News of the World, which was founded in 1843. Why? Because their reporters, and it's not clear how high up this goes, though it looks like it goes quite high up, and by the time this airs, we might know a lot more, that they hacked into the phones, News of the World, and probably other reporters and other papers will see. And let's not forget, this is not just a British story, because Rupert Murdoch owns the New York Post, owns Fox, owns the Wall Street Journal in this country, and he moves around his staff, and those involved in this could well be now running these American papers as well. He's trying to get this Sky deal to own TV satellite network Sky. And yet this is stopping him because the British government is now investigating how it was that, well, we now believe these reporters and paper hacked into perhaps 4,000 phones of everyone from the families of the British war dead to a girl who was 13 years old, and this is what has just captured this country, and it's thanks to investigative journalist Nick Davies of The Guardian, who broke several of the key stories in this scandal. What has really grabbed the attention of the British people is this missing teenager, a girl, 13 years old, named Millie Dowler. While police were looking for her, when it wasn't determined she'd been murdered but was missing, suddenly, her parents were finding that her cell phone, the voicemails were being deleted. And so, of course, hanging on to any thread of hope they could, they believed that that their daughter, that Millie, was alive. Who else would be able to delete her voicemail? And they took this as a great source of comfort and hope. The fact of the matter was, the reporter at News of the World was deleting these voicemail one by one, and then covering the family as they would announce that a voicemail was deleted, hoping that that meant little Millie was alive. This has infuriated the British population. And this is just one story. It goes on from there. Yes, hacking into, you know, the phones of Prince William, hacking into the head of the National Footballer Association. Now, in some of these cases, they were already exposed, and the head of the National Footballer Association, a soccer association of Britain, sued and got some huge amount of money. But that was all silenced over these years. And it goes right on up to the Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron's Director of Communications, Andy Coulson, was just arrested on corruption and phone hacking charges because before he became the spokesperson for David Cameron, he recently stepped down before his arrest. He was a reporter with News of the World. And David Cameron, the question is, how much did he know before this happened? And how high up does this go as the, you know, Rupert Murdoch's in Britain dealing with this scandal? I mean, this shows us how huge the empire is, and it exposes this very ugly underbelly of it. We'll see what happens. Story is certainly not fully told yet.
It seems, Amy Goodman, another part of the story that comes out that is of tremendous importance here in the United States and worldwide is the degree to which Rupert Murdoch really, for lack of a more polite term, sort of owns politicians in England, that his media power has given him just extraordinarily extraordinary influence across both all the political parties, and that give him sort of carte blanche, so he thought he'd probably get away with stuff like this.
Oh, absolutely. And not only the politicians owns the politicians, but the police and Scotland Yard. They were hiring police detectives. They were paying for information from Scotland Yard. I mean, this is could shake the institutions, the permanent government of Britain in a very huge way. And there's another very interesting story, an issue of media consolidation in this country. You know, at the same time we covered this on Democracy Now!, we did a story on the Philadelphia federal court striking down the FCC's attempt to relax media ownership rules. Sadly, instead of the Federal Communications Commission protecting the media landscape in this country and keeping it diverse, it's passed a rule that made it easier for a single company like Rupert Murdoch's News Corp in this country to own a newspaper and a broadcast outlet in a single market. In fact, Rupert Murdoch has a permanent waiver in New York that allows him to own, for example, the New York Post and Fox. But the court ruling marks the second time that the appeals court has intervened in the FCC's attempts to relax media ownership rules. And very significant, and this lawsuit was brought by the Prometheus Radio Project, which said media consolidation has a particularly terrible impact on ownership by those who are historically disenfranchised in the media system, like women, people of color, workers, the poor, anyone whose voice is not already represented in our media. So there is a good, you know, this is a very positive story and very surprising for many that the court has once again overturned the FCC, which is supposed to be the watchdog, but instead is allowing this media consolidation to happen. You know, I think this comes from people power all over the United States, people across the political spectrum who say we don't want these media moguls like Rupert Murdoch to control the entire information flow in this country.
Amy Goodman, I must say, I think now that Bill Moyers' program is no longer carried on public television, Democracy Now! May be the only general news program that's not aimed at a business investor audience that covers this issue. I mean, you're really all alone in covering media policy debates in the United States.
Well, you know, your organization, Bob, Free Press, has been so important in really calling attention to all of this. And it is absolutely key that the media cover this. Of course, they tend not to because often behind the scenes, it's these networks that are writing the amicus briefs to increase media consolidation. And what they find, rather than, you know, even if they did the story and they only had people on supporting media consolidation, I think the studies show that as soon as anyone gets even a whiff of this, no matter what information is put out there, they're opposed to, you know, one network owning the radio, television, and newspaper in a town. And so they simply don't cover it. It's absolutely our job in the media to go to where the silence is, to let people know what is happening. I mean, the media are the most important institutions on earth, more powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile, is the media. When you hear an idea, when it explodes in your mind, how that can shift the way you see the world and the way others see us. And the media is the way we come to understand the world and the way the rest of the media, the rest of the world comes to understand us. And we have to keep it open and free.
Amy Goodman, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, we recorded this program a couple weeks before going on air, so please don't try to call in. Amy, just real quickly, I'd like to ask your comments and thoughts on a couple of American news media. First and foremost, since we've been talking about Rupert Murdoch, what's your sense of Fox News and sort of its political role, not just as a media, you know, but what role does it play in American political life?
Well, it is certainly, to say the least, making the debate incredibly vitriolic and one-sided. It is there to incubate candidates for president, it seems. You have these, you know, hosts on Fox that go on to run for president, everyone from Newt Gingrich to now, well, we'll see what happens with Sarah Palin and Rick Santorum and, who, you know, a number of folks who use this as their launching pad, but it's the idea of not having a fair, honest, and open debate that is so problematic, so critical to the functioning of a democratic society. You know, Democracy Now! Began 15 years ago. We're in our 15th anniversary year, which is very exciting, on a few dozen community radio stations. And we're now at almost 1,000 stations, increasingly on PBS stations, on NPR stations. We started on Pacifica Radio, on community and college stations. And I think it's because there is a hunger across the political spectrum to hear people speaking for themselves, not just the pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. I mean, you start off with the facts. You know, for example, you know, how many media outlets are owned by one media mogul? This is not in dispute. And then you have a discussion about whether this is working for a democratic society. Or when we're talking about war, how important it is that we know the facts and figures about how much war costs, whether in lives or in money, how important it is that we keep it on the front burner. It seems that the coverage of Iraq and Afghanistan goes down, even as we're now involved in the longest war in U.S. history in Afghanistan. Hardly realize how we've extended into Pakistan, and it's not only on those fronts, but in Libya, in Yemen. When young men and not so young men and women are being sent to war, to kill or be killed, to live or die, it is our responsibility in the media to provide a forum for the discussion and debate about war and peace, about life and death. And to talk about these issues, no matter where you stand on these issues. I mean, I speak all over the country. I can't tell you how many soldiers and veterans come up to me and say, thank you for just showing that war is a reality in this country right now and talking about it, that the U.S. is engaged in these wars. We can never forget. And I often think about the story of this painting by Pablo Picasso that hung at the UN Security Council for decades. It's the tapestry of this famous anti-war symbol, the Guernica. A lot of people might know it, but it was a picture of a war bombed, of a town in Spain bombed during the Franco years. And it became a famous anti-war symbol. Pablo Picasso painted it in a rage of 21 days. He had weavers make three tapestry reproductions of it because he wanted it to travel all over the world. So at the UN, in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, there it was hanging right outside the UN Security Council. And when Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, and other U.S. officials were making their pro-war announcements for the invasion of Iraq, it wasn't lost on the U.S. and U.N. officials the irony of making these statements against this anti-war backdrop. And so they pulled a curtain over the tapestry. It's our job in the media to pull that curtain back, to show the realities of war.
Amy Goodman, our guest in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Amy, it was about 11 years ago almost that you were working at WBAI New York one day, shortly, I think it was Election Day, in fact, in 2000. Mm-hmm. And Bill Clinton called in to do sort of a pep talk on getting people out to vote. You ever have them call radio stations around the country, sitting President Bill Clinton. And you sort of grabbed the microphone and were able to have an unplanned, unscheduled interview where you were able to ask him a series of questions on a number of issues that you'd been covering that he had never really been asked about by any other reporters. And for those interested or listeners, I mean, you can go online and find copies of the transcript or listen to it if you go to a search engine. But what I wanted to ask you is if by chance today President Barack Obama were to call in and you were able to get him for, say, 20 minutes, half hour, 45 minutes to interview him directly one-on-one, what are the questions you would ask him?
You know, it's interesting. I wrote about this encounter with Clinton in my first book that I wrote with my brother David Goodman called The Exception to the Rulers, and that should be the motto of all the media, by the way, The Exception to the Rulers. But I think they would be very similar. You know, Bob, I really think we started off, as you said, Clinton asked, Clinton wanted to come on, he went on about 40 radio stations that day, and he wanted to tell people to get out the vote. And, I mean, this was a tremendous opportunity to ask the most powerful person on earth some questions. He called us. We didn't call him. And I started by, you know, asking him why most people don't vote in this country, and if it's, you know, how he responds to those who say they feel both parties are captured by the corporations. I don't think that has changed much. I went on to ask him about the bombing of Vieques. That's not still happening. The Puerto Rican island, they were napalming at the U.S. Navy, and eventually that stopped when it was exposed. I also asked him, interestingly, about the sanctions against Iraq, and we're still dealing with Iraq today and the number of people who have died. I asked him about racial profiling. We could certainly still talk about that, and asked him about Leonard Peltier and whether he was considering, this is the first time he publicly addressed this issue, granting him executive clemency, the Native American leader who is imprisoned for life, convicted of the killing of two FBI agents. This is a crime he says he did not commit. Now, he still is in jail, and I could ask President Obama this very same question. But I also asked President Clinton about whether what does he say about those who say he's responsible for, well, remember Ralph Nader was running at that time, Ralph Nader's success for taking the Democratic Party to the right. So if you look at President Obama today, when we talk about Afghanistan, we can't talk about Bush's war. We have to talk about Obama's war. When we talk about the Great Recession that we are in right now and who has paid the most dearly and who has benefited, the questions of why he has chosen President Obama to surround himself by Wall Street. As we speak, President Obama agreeing to serious cuts in Medicare and Social Security. And yet, where is the discussion about cutting, the Pentagon budget and stopping these wars that have cost us all so much? So in an interesting way, I think many of the questions would be the same.
And I suspect many of the answers would be the same, too. Amy Goodman, one of the things we were talking about before we went on air, and you know, your program covers international politics as well, I think, as thoroughly as any American-based news broadcast. So that's not saying a great deal, unfortunately. And, you know, what do you think the big stories going on in the world right now are that are not being covered by and large in the U.S. news media?
Oh, there are so many. One is the privatization of war. And there's no one who does that better than Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy was a Democracy Now! Producer and now correspondent for years. He wrote the best-selling book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, has done this remarkable reporting on, an issue that concerns many American soldiers as well. Because when you talk about the privatization of war, these contractors, you know, when we talk about the numbers of soldiers who will be left in Afghanistan with President Obama's latest plan, that isn't cutting back on soldiers. It's just cutting back on the Obama surge of soldiers, just restores it to the number that, in fact, is well more than President Bush left office with. But we don't talk about the private armies that remain there, the contractors that number more than the soldiers themselves. And when you have these private contractors, whether we're talking about Blackwater or any of the others, and Blackwater, by the way, has a new name now. It often has a new name. Most recently, it's ZXE.
They sort of going into the Corporate Witness Protection Program or something?
Except that we know where they are, and they are, and because of, you know, investigative reporters like Jeremy follow them, continue to follow them very carefully, whether we're talking about Triple Canopy or DynCorp or Blackwater Z. The laws around these private companies are very vague. You know, the accountability, the lack of accountability. And this is a story that must be told from Iraq to Afghanistan to Somalia, from Yemen to so many different places that we don't even know about now. And the issue of overall accountability. It might surprise many that when it comes to issues of torture that united so many people across the political spectrum during the Bush years, why the Obama administration has refused to allow prosecutions of those who engaged in this during the Bush years. Because if we're concerned about our standing in the world, it's not only about simply holding those in power accountable, but will this happen again? I mean, interestingly, it's just a straightforward law and order position. If someone, you know, abuses their power, if someone tortures, hurts, or kills someone, we believe in this country that they should be held accountable, that they should be punished. And that's not only because of the individual, they should be punished, but to set an example for everyone else. That's what law and order is all about. And so, interestingly, it's a law and order position that is asking for an accounting of what has taken place in our name in this country. But I think those kinds of issues aren't covered, and also the huge gap, the growing gap between rich and poor that's ever increasing. We talk about unemployment being at 9.2 and beyond, but in the African-American community, they could only dream of it being 9.2, because we're talking about 16%, and in, what, young men between the ages of, what, 18 and 30, 40, we're talking about upwards of 50%. We have to cover what is happening in this country as well, and not just from the perspective of, you know, the network elite that don't experience this, and their friends don't experience it, so they don't cover it. But from the target end of policy, you know, exactly what it feels like, what it looks like, and then we will, you know, I think when you reflect that, then people seriously come up with solutions. It's all a part of the functioning of a democratic society.
Amy, I think you have your finger oftentimes in the pulse as a journalist more than most others, and, you know, we're in a moment now, as you've already described it, of economic stagnation or recession. We're in the third or fourth year. And at this point in time, no one in power thinks there's any way out in the near term. And I think a lot of people, polling shows, have internalized that this country's going to continue to stagnate with all that that means for the standard of living and the quality of lives and the threats to the public budget and public programs. And at the same time, what we're seeing, not just worldwide in places like Spain and Greece, but also here in the United States, increasingly in places like Wisconsin, is a tremendous upheaval of popular opposition to sort of what's going on. And I just wanted your take as a journalist who's been covering politics for a couple decades now. You know, are we in sort of, is this is more of what's been going on, we're just paying attention, or are we at a turning point of some sort? Or where are we at, in your view, sort of historically?
Well, I mean, that is really key. You know, Democracy Now! Is right there on the scene in Tahrir for the most remarkable 18 days of uprising that continues actually through this day, uprising to knock out the long reigning despot there, Mubarak. Our senior producer, Shufuddin Qudus, was just remarkable in his reporting. He himself, a son of Egypt, went back to Egypt, and he's our correspondent there now. But we not only covered the uprisings in the Middle East, we covered the uprisings from the Middle East to the Midwest as well. And what happened in Wisconsin is very, very important. Not only what happened in Madison and what's happening with Governor Walker's bills now, the union busting bills that he has gotten passed, but, you know, courts intervening now, all sorts of reelection campaigns being held. It's not only Wisconsin. That was ground zero for it in this country. We were broadcasting from the Capitol Rotunda in Madison, where we had one guy was holding a sign, a young man who was an Iraq war veteran. He had just come back, and he was holding a sign, I left Iraq and returned to Cairo, he said, because there he was. And you had people in Cairo ordering pizza at Ian's Pizza in Madison for the people who are sleeping in the Capitol Rotunda. But, you know, we live in a globalized world now, and this is what the Internet affords, people to communicate horizontally, you know, across the world. But what's happening in Wisconsin is not only happening there. It's happening in Michigan. It's happening in Ohio with the major protests in Columbus. It's happening in Arizona. It's happening in Texas. And There is a kind of shift of wealth that we have not seen the likes of in many decades, and people at the grassroots are responding. And I think it's absolutely critical that the media pay attention. If there is a Tea Party gathering of 200, you might have as many reporters there, but you have a gathering of thousands of people and of progressives, for example, who are speaking out against war, against the shrinking budgets for the safety net in this country, and you hardly get any coverage. We have to have a uniform standard of how we report on these issues. And I think that most people in this country do deeply care about their neighbors and about how we're going to get by. And when we have that discussion where we include people at ground zero, that's when the discussion will be honest and will lead to better solutions. But people on the ground in Madison, it was amazing to see. And the profound nature of that struggle that's been going on there. I was there in the freezing cold when 150,000 people, I mean, these were the largest protests in Wisconsin's history, and you know this well, Bob, you live in the area. But to see, for example, the History Museum just on the corner of the Capitol there, and to think about the history of what has made this country great, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, the home of AFSCME, established, I think, in 1932, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, so much the target of Governor Walker's policies. Think about Dr. King. Is there a connection? I mean, he died in Memphis when he was marching with local sanitation workers in 1968 who were trying to establish an AFSCME local. That's how profound what the people in Wisconsin were doing again now.
Amy Goodman, our guest in Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. Again, this is a recorded show, so just sit back, relax, and let us do the talking today. And, you know, Amy, one of the questions I get a lot, and it's one I'd like to ask you, what in your view would you tell a young person who wants to be a journalist, and they say, what is good journalism? What do you think the constituent parts of good journalism or a good approach to journalism are?
Being fair and accurate, digging deep into a story, and again, not getting those pundits who know so little about so much on, but getting people who are most closely affected by whatever story it is you are covering. I think that's why people tune into Democracy Now, because it's news with a heart, news with compassion, simply because it's providing a forum for people to speak for themselves, not to have others describe their experience. And, you know, the basic principles of good journalism are follow the money. I mean, that's extremely important. You know, when you're looking at the Tea Party, well, who's funding it? Take a look at the Koch brothers, very close to folks in the greater Wisconsin area, certainly, right? And the Koch brothers' father, Charles and David Koch's father, Fred Koch, one of the co-founders of the John Birch Society, look at where they're funding, putting their money. I dare say they would not have tea with the members of the Tea Party that they fund. But it's important to do this as we move into an election year, at the Democratic Convention, at the Republican Convention. Who's funding the Republican Governors Association? Well, we know Rupert Murdoch gave $1 million. You know, the Koch brothers gave $1 million. Who's funding the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee? Yes, it's important to follow the money. And it's important to go to where the silence is. You know, during the Republican Convention of 2008, we had covered the mass protests at the Democratic Convention in Denver, then went on to do it in St. Paul, and I was arrested with my colleagues, Sharif Abdelkaddous, who did such a great job later on in Egypt covering the uprising, and Nicole Salazar, a multimedia producer. Why were we arrested? We were simply attempting to cover not just what was happening on the convention floor, but the protests in the streets, where the uninvited guests are, because democracy is a messy thing, and it's our job to capture it all. And we shouldn't have to get a record when we try to put things on the record. So it is our job, no matter how difficult it is, to go to where the silence is and either say something or provide a forum for people to speak for themselves.
And I guess conversely, Amy Goodman, what are the signs of bad journalism? What are the things someone should avoid if they want to do good journalism?
We see see it all the time in Washington when the media acts as a megaphone for those in power. You know, those in power have their paid spokespeople. They're doing just fine. The media is supposed to level the playing field. There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power, not supposed to be cozying up to power. That is our job. It's not to win a popularity contest. It is to provide a forum for people who are not usually heard. And I must say that those people who are not usually heard are not just a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. We got to take the media back. It's what will save us. The media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. And instead, in this country, it is simply beat the drums for war. And that has to stop. It does not serve any of us. And it doesn't serve the generals. It doesn't serve the soldiers. It doesn't serve civilians. We have to have an open, robust decision about the discussion about the most serious decisions a country can make, which is to go to war, not just act as a, you know, as a megaphone for those in power who decide to go to war. And I always cite this study, but I want to do it very quickly. This is not, you know, just speculation that this is the way the U.S. media works. The group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, did a study of the month leading up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. They looked at the four major nightly newscasts on NBC, ABC, CBS, and PBS, and they looked at the 2 weeks around February 5th, 2003, when Colin Powell gave a speech for going to war with Iraq at the United Nations. There were 393 interviews done around war in that two-week period, a month before the invasion. Only three of those interviews were with anti-war leaders. That's three of almost 400 when half the population is opposed to war. That is no longer a mainstream media. That's an extreme media beating the drums for war.
Amy Goodman, do you think you could do Democracy Now, or the Democracy Now could be done on a station that was owned by a corporation and supported itself, with the revenues coming almost overwhelmingly from advertising?
I mean, people who care about honest, accurate reporting, I think it is, you know, there's a reason why our home has been public media, is because we're not brought to viewers and listeners by the weapons manufacturers. We're not brought to viewers and listeners by the oil, gas, and coal companies when we're talking about global warming. We're not brought to listeners and viewers by the insurance company or big pharma, the drug companies, when we're talking about health care. We're brought to, I don't even want to say audiences, but, you know, we're brought to the population by listeners and viewers. And I think that is the most honest way to ensure an honest, authentic media, and not brought to you by the vested interests, but protected by populations because they care about getting the truth on any range of issues.
Amy Goodman, we've got about 5 minutes or so left on the show, and I'd like to change course for the balance of the program. One of the features of Democracy Now! That I most appreciate is that you oftentimes have author interviews with authors who write books and don't get a lot of attention otherwise, oftentimes great books. And on one hand, I'm amazed that you're able to read so much, given the demands in your time. It simply astounds me. But secondly, you know, so who are some of the authors you've had on that you've been especially pleased with your ability to have them on the air to expose the work they're doing?
Oh, my gosh. There are so many people who've done such interesting books.
Well, maybe go recently to make it so you're not like you're picking your best, but just in recent weeks or months.
Oh, let's see. We recently interviewed Christian Parenti, who wrote a very interesting book exposing how global warming could lead to global warfare. Christian has done books on the prison industrial complex, and his book is called Tropic of Chaos, and it's a fascinating look at what's happening, taking very seriously the whole issue of climate change, Tropic of Chaos, climate change, and the new geography of violence. Also, just interviewing John Sayles. Now, we think of him as a great independent filmmaker who did Return of the Secaucus 7 and Matewan. His recent efforts, while there was a Screenwriters Guild strike and he couldn't do movies, he wrote, unbelievably enough, a 1,000-page tome called A Moment in the Sun, an amazing epic story going from the Philippine War and what happened in 1898 to today. Talking with Paul Farmer, who is this remarkable doctor, came out of Boston, but has been doing global health now for decades, particularly in Haiti, and just wrote a book about Haiti. Talking with people whose books hardly get attention in this country, but international authors as well, from Arundhati Roy, the great writer who wrote God of Small Things and now writes books, essays, to Tariq Ali, who writes everything from Iraq to what's happening in this country, to Alice Walker. Now, we've had Alice Walker on a number of times, most recently, because she was a part of this attempt by a group of Americans to challenge the Israeli blockade of Gaza, to take a ship named after President Obama's best-selling book, The Audacity of Hope, a ship they hoped to sail from Athens, Greece, to Gaza, and they were stopped by the Greek government that was getting pressured by both the United States government and the Israeli government. But we followed her journey, and I think, you know, what she did there very much is in line with her writings about social justice.
You know, Amy, this is great. Let me just conclude then with, you know, who are the journalists that you like to read or look at every day to follow their work? Who are the journalists that sort of inspire you and you find is really zeroing in on the issues that you think are important and getting to the bottom of it?
Well, I'm really honored to work with the people who are my media heroes. For example, Juan Gonzalez. Juan, his forthcoming book is an epic work, and it's called News for All the People. And it's going to be coming out in September. His most recent book that also just came out, it's an updated book called Harvest of Empire, The History of Latinos in America. And it is particularly important now because the updated version comes after the massive protests of 2006, some of the largest protests there have ever been in this country, and that was around immigration. And Juan has always been an inspiration for me. We started Democracy Now! Together 15 years ago. He just won the George Polk Award for his coverage of the biggest corruption scandal in New York history. It's a scandal that's taken place in New York City, and he is the one who exposed it. It's called City Time, and it's about some contractors who just pilfered millions and millions of dollars. But Juan is just someone who has inspired me for so long, and my colleagues, you know, from Sherif Odokadus reporting from Egypt to Jeremy Scahill to Anjali Kamat, who did such incredible work from India to Yemen. She went into, from India to Libya, where she traveled several times. Even our fellows. I mean, we work with a group of young fellows.
You know, Amy, at this note, I'm getting the signal from my producer, unfortunately, that we are rapidly approaching the end of the hour. And I just want to thank you so much for taking time off to talk to us today here at Media Matters.
Oh, and thank you, Bob, for your great work and both your media activism and this great show.
Well, thank you very much. Have a great day. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank the staff here at WILL for helping produce the show. I'll be back with you in 167 hours. Until then, everyone, have a great summer.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
And now a look at the weather forecast. Today it's sunny with a high near 91. Tonight, mostly clear skies with a low around 70. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 91. Heat index values as high as 101. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 93. A chance of showers and thunderstorms Tuesday night. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.